the recorder. There we go. Well, welcome everybody to a very special edition, White Inch edition of Desert Island Discs. I'm Kirsty, apparently.
You're not a good looking stuff.
And my first guest is the wonderful Neil Scott. So this is a really exciting opportunity to hear a bit about the lives of my three guests today and hear some music that they picked out as well, which is very diverse and varied. So I'm looking forward to that. So, Neil.
Hello.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you.
Don't call me Kirsty. We'd just like to hear a bit about your life, really. You want to tell us where you were born and where you grew up?
Born in Bells Hill, grew up in East Kilbride, more years ago than I care to divulge here. Quite a happy childhood and a loving family that certainly provided all my needs, and that's not to say all my wants, but obviously I was a kind of child and young person that wanted a lot.
Yeah. And do you have siblings? Or?
Yes, I have a brother who's a year older than me and a sister who's 3 years younger than me. Yeah. We were always quite close and grew up to an extent with the same type of music, you know.
Okay.
Influenced each other quite a lot that way.
Was there a bit of a history and a heritage of music in your household? Or did you pick that up for yourself? Or?
It was mostly picked up for myself. I remember when, just shortly after my 12th birthday, my mum said, "Oh, you can now get your adult library tickets." And I thought, God, I'm 12, I want a guitar or a mic, you know. And the lady at the library said, "Oh, we have a record library."
Oh, wow.
And I just did a flick through the hundreds, maybe thousands of albums that they had there, saw London Calling by The Clash, and just was so taken by the iconic front cover of it. I thought, this looks really interesting, you know, and that really started my love affair with music.
Yeah, well, you're certainly somebody who has a real passion for music, and you're into all sorts of different stuff, so that's something that's very evident in you. So, you want to tell us a wee bit about your kind of teenage years?
Bookish and studious for the most part. Yep. didn't really rebel in terms of alcohol or any kind of misbehaviour until I was about 18. I had moved into student digs in Glasgow. I was going to Glasgow University.
Okay.
And that opened a whole world of opportunity for that sort of behaviour, you know.
But, yeah. So, I think it's maybe time to hear a sample of your first selection, which is an old hymn tune, "Dear Lord and Father of Mankind," the Ripton tune. Do you want to tell us why you picked that and why that's important to you?
Well, when you asked me to pick five songs, I was talking to Brian about this earlier on, and I went, right, five songs, it's like, music, to me, is not just music, there are connotations that go with it. I first heard "Dear Lord and Father of Mankind" at my maternal grandpa's funeral.
Okay.
And so it has a kind of melancholy that way, because I was 7 when he died, and I remember being quite moved by the rendition of it that was sung at the church, and it just always has been kind of important to me. Also the fact that, again, when you asked five songs, I think, right, it's not just five songs that I like necessarily, it's five ideas that are important to me, and the idea of a loving God who's forgiving is the most important factor of my life just now, you know.
Great. Okay, well, that's brilliant. I'm just going to play us a little sample of that piece so people can hear it. So, Neil, I understand that you have worked as a police officer, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I had the misapprehension that you probably should have when you're 17, that you think you're going to be at that age and stage for far longer than you are. Mm-hmm. I went to Glasgow Uni aged 17 to study history and politics, and it had to be that. I could not have done a 4-year course in something that didn't really interest me. History always did, particularly Scottish history, so that's what I went to study. And I thought, I remember being in Freshers Week there thinking, right, I've got 4 years to decide what I want to do. And it seemed like later that afternoon, I was like, right, I'm 21. I have no clearer idea now what I want to do than I did when I was 17. And my degree had been quite specific. So it didn't exactly open the doors of, I was going to say, Thatcher's Britain. But even at my colossal age, I can say John Major's Britain at that point. You know, it didn't open a lot of doors. I was applying for jobs that paid, at the time, about $6,000 or $7,000 a year, and I wasn't even getting replies. And then Strathclyde Police put full-page adverts in the Herald and the Scotsman saying, have you thought about a career in the police? Join the police, we'll start you on $17,000, you'll get a pay rise every year, you'll get your rent allowance, your clothing allowance and all the rest. And I thought, well, I'll throw my hat into that ring, fired off an application, and 6 months later I was a policeman, you know. That was to go on for the next 12 and a half years, me being a police officer. On the whole, I really enjoyed it. But I can tell you with complete honesty just now, the only thing I miss is the wage coming in. You know? And sometimes when you feel that way about a job, I mean, your working life, particularly in a role like that, it's such a big part of your life that unless it makes you happy, you owe it to yourself to do something else. And I think I probably realised that quite quickly, but again, thought, you know, I wouldn't be doing this forever, and then all of a sudden I was like, wait a minute, I've done for nearly 13 years, you know. My youth was gone, but I was still a young man, and I can do something else, you know.
So, well, do you want to tell us about your second selection in Elvis Presley in the Ghetto?
Elvis Presley in the Ghetto was the first record that my son James heard.
Okay.
When we came back from the hospital, he was 3 days old. I remember having him in my arms and thinking, it's maybe time I introduced him to music. And it was in the Ghetto that I played. And obviously, at that time, I was 31, I think. James was 3 days old. And again, it's to do with the connotations of music.
Yeah.
When you're a 40-something guy, there's a lot of life that you can look back on with a certain amount of regret, but holding that new baby and listening to Elvis isn't one of those moments.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's have a wee listen to some of that then.
as the snow flies. On a cold and grey Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries.
She doesn't want to cry.
Cause if there's one thing she don't need, it's another hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto. People, don't you understand? The child needs a helping hand. He'll grow to be an angry young man someday. Take a look at you and me. Are we too blind to see? Do we simply turn our heads and look the other way? Well, the world.
So there's Elvis in the ghetto. Great. So were you still working as a police officer when James was born?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Okay. And do you want to tell us?
I think they gave me the morning off.
So you came to the point where you realised you didn't want to do this forever.
Yeah, I didn't want to do it forever, yeah.
And so, so kind of what happened then?
Well, it seemed to me that there was a whole lot going on for me at that point in terms of, I knew that the marriage was failing. I didn't know how to fix it, and don't know if I probably wasn't prepared to put in the effort to fix it. By the time I had made a definite decision to leave the police, my ex-wife Claire was pregnant again with Mirren, you know, and I remember being delighted when Mirren came along. I think, right, I've only got two, and that's the full set. yep.
Okay, and well, actually, I'm going to segue, sort of just jump on your list, because you mentioned one of your selections, actually, you referred to it as Mirren Song.
Yeah.
You want to tell me a wee bit about that and introduce that?
It is by a band called the Manic Street Preachers, who I got into when I was 19. I would be 1990. They first got a recording contract and started releasing music. And it's the last time that a band has instantly grabbed me.
Okay.
And I've been quite into it, particularly the live shows. I found quite spectacular.
Have you seen them playing live?
Oh yeah, a few times then. Yeah, I think I've seen them every time they've played in Glasgow, bar twice, you know. And the live shows are always great. I remember when Mirren was only about 3 or 4, and she was interested into where I had been to see a concert.
Yeah.
I had been at the Badlands seeing the Manics, and I remember her asking me, did they play Rock and Roll Robots? She'd been watching some kids' TV programme and Rock and Roll Robot was one of the songs. And I just remember thinking, God, I wish they had. The Manics always remind me of Mirren,
yeah.
You know, and Stay Beautiful it's a beautifully crafted song. I mean, it's a real three chords, but I just like it, you
know. Okay, well let's listen to a little piece of Manic Street Preachers' Stay Beautiful.
Thank you.
Backstreet Preachers. Fantastic. Yes. Are they still making music?
They are still making music, still touring quite regularly, but one of their founder members is the guy Richie Edwards,
right,
who disappeared. And it's such a kind of middle-aged abuso thing to say, but they never had the same appeal to me since.
So, do you want to tell us a wee bit about life after the police force then, and kind of your kind of most recent years?
Well, the first and most important factor to look at is there is life after the police force. they would tell you different somehow, you know. But after that, I spent a long time doing temping type admin jobs that served a purpose in bringing in a small amount of money. Around that time, I decided to take my what had been teenage brief flirtation with substance abuse to whole new levels, and that just destroyed what there was in my life at that point, you know. Entirely self-inflicted, but that is the way that it was, you know. Personal relationships with everybody around about me, particularly with James and Mirren, just fell away. Any sense that I had of propriety with regards to behaviour and money just went absolutely awry, and I got myself in a lot of bother and had a fairly large and serious brain hemorrhage as a result of substance misuse, you know, which you can look on in any way you want. It's just what happened. At the time, I was looking on it as a dreadful calamity that increased my victim status that I'd given myself. And I try and be a lot more open-minded about it now. It stopped me doing what I was doing. It made me seek help. And if I hadn't been for that episode, I don't know if I would have done. You know?
So that moment was a real turning point?
That moment was a real turning point, yeah.
And how were you able to seek help after that?
After that, I sought help through a drug fellowship who have regular meetings and offer support and basically friendship and understanding were big parts of that, and getting started on a programme of recovery, a 12-step recovery, part of which was the recognition that you can ask God to do what you can't do yourself. And of course, fellowships tend not to be particularly direct in terms of instruction. Mm-hmm. Say, look, this is available, and God is the higher power of your understanding. And that worked well for me, but it's maybe not how I see it now. It's maybe the way it's got to be when you've got some bug-eyed, drug-addicted person, you know. You can't force them to do anything. You can tell them what you've done, you can tell them what you believe in. I would never deny. I've been asked point blank on numerous occasions, all right, so you've been in 12-step recovery, what's your higher power? And without skipping a beat, I will say Jesus Christ. I couldn't have seen myself saying that years ago, but that is how it is for me, you know. The realisation that drink and drugs were no longer an issue for me was a huge relief and source of gratitude, but God had done something for me. I wasn't doing anything for God. I wasn't even going to church at that point. And I spoke to a lot of folk in the fellowship that I attend. Maybe God wants you to go to church. I'm going to start looking at that and see how it works for me. You know, and that was what brought me in the doors of White Inch Church, and I am very grateful that that has been my journey with it.
Fantastic. Well, it's been great seeing your journey for the last little bit that those of us who are around here at White Inch have been able to experience. It's been really, really amazing to see that. So we're going to listen now to a band that you mentioned very early on that were the stirring of your musical interest. Do you want to tell us a bit about The Clash and why this track is important to you?
This track, I love the way that The Clash were very much a product of 1970s punk rock, and the album that I mentioned, London Calling, has got a huge variety of styles on it. You know where their schooling was, but they try different things. They try reggae, blue beat, ska, and so on. I just like what they do with this song.
So this is a song called Rudy Can't Fail.
Rudy Can't Fail, yeah.
From The Clash's London Calling LP. So let's hear a piece of that. London Calling, and I don't know if you can see it, but the image on the front is of a guitar about to be smashed on a stage, which breaks my heart as a guitarist.
That's what I do. I've got a good book of photographs by the guy that took that photograph, and he's got one that's maybe 3 seconds earlier, and it's the bassist Paul Simon and actually playing it, and the caption is, "This bass has 15 seconds to live."
So you kind of mentioned your children James and Mirren, and it's really great, obviously, the way things have moved on. You now have kind of great relationship with them again, when you'd kind of lost that before. You were saying you're able to see them regularly now, and
I'm able to see them regularly, and the way that God works in our lives meant that about 18 months ago I got James to live with me permanently. And to describe that as anything other than an absolute joy would be disgraceful. You know what I mean? I like to joke about it, you know. He'd be more used on a desert island than he would in a 2-bedroom flat. But it's a relationship that I value more than anything else that I have. I get to see Mirren whenever I want. I remember two years ago now, saying to the pair of them on a Sunday morning, we were up and we'd had our breaks, I'm going to church, and if I'm going to church, it means that you two are coming as well. Mirren was prepared to go along with that. James came kicking and screaming, and a remarkable transformation has taken place in him since then, and now he takes me kicking and screaming to church on a Sunday morning.
That's fantastic. I know it's been a huge joy to you to watch God at work in James's life and see him really coming to life in Jesus as well. So that's fantastic. Okay, so we've one more final track to hear, an album that I really love actually, a track by The Killers called Mr. Brightside. Do you want to tell us why you picked that and a little bit about that track?
Because I'm Mr. Brightside. Again, a band that when I first heard them, and obviously there's a lot of connotations about that song that aren't particularly good, being steaming drunk in pubs and clubs and so on. But I thought it was interesting the way that the band puts this song together.
Yeah.
There's a wee bit of spoken word, and there's beautiful interplay between the guitars and bass.
Yeah.
You know, I'd feel silly saying that to anyone other than
I love it, and I just loved the energy of what they did with this first album. It was really kind of exciting to listen to. So let's have a little listen to Mr. Brightside from The Killers. Okay, Neil, well, it's been really brilliant hearing about your story and hearing about your journey. One last question for you would be, what do you think the future holds for you?
The absolute certainty that if I can give myself a few moments in the morning and the evening to ask God sincerely that His will be done rather than mine, that the future is something that I really look forward to, you know. Yep.
That's a brilliant answer. Thank you. Neil Scott. Okay, well, I'd like to invite Brian Kelman up now. Welcome, Brian. Let me just load your playlist on here. So we have your selection all ready to go. So,
cool.
I know. On trial. Okay. Here we go. Everybody all right? All right. So, Brian Kelman, welcome. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us. And I'm really excited to hear a bit of your story and to talk about the music you've chosen as well. So, do you want to tell us where you were born and where you grew up and a little bit about your childhood memories and stuff like that?
So I was born in Aberdeen, grew up there until I was about 17 and came down here. So my childhood memories are very good. We lived in a little scheme, but there was loads of kids and loads of adventurous kids. So it was great, good clean fun, so quite early on music became sort of part of my life. I wanted to learn the violin, fiddle, and I thought I was really good at it until I must have been about 11 or 12 and thought, oh my goodness, this is so that was shattered, but it's always been part of my life, some of my family, although not really musicians, music was obviously part of their life as well.
There a lot of music in your household growing up then?
There was for me, because I was always listening to what was probably then Radio 2, although it sort of moved on.
Yeah.
It's now electric, it wasn't sort of clockwork in mind. My playing sort of introduced me to other music as well. So quite early on, I had quite a kind of varied taste. Mm-hmm. in music.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a very varied taste in your selection, and I notice, you know, there are some kind of classical choices in there. Is that as a result of learning to play the violin a bit, or was that?
Part of that, and my sister, who's a bit older than me, she had a boyfriend at this point who introduced her to what you would call classical music, more serious music, and I thought, I really like that.
Yeah.
And I was quite surprised. So again, that was another avenue that I kind of explored.
Great. Okay. Well, do you want to tell us about your first selection, which is Sunshine of Your Love by Cream?
By Cream, yeah. So I grew up... I was aware of the music, big time, late 60s, early 70s, well, late 60s, I suppose, or 60s, so it was the time of the Beatles, the big explosion of the Beatles, Bob Dylan, various people like that, and I loved the blues, the real basic blues, and then there's electric blues, and so on. So very sort of varied musical tastes. So Cream was one of my favourites. So that's why I've chosen. They're sort of representative
of that kind of era of music. Okay, brilliant. Let's have a wee listen to part of this thing, okay. Sunshine of Your Love.
Okay.
Okay, so you told us you were in Aberdeen until about the age of 17.
Yeah.
So what brought you down? Did you come down to Glasgow after that? Or?
I came down here to university.
Okay.
But even before I left Aberdeen, I was sort of aware that there's a bit more to life than, you know, heavy rock music and stuff like that. So my friends were going off and doing the usual things that teenage boys do, and I thought, well, I don't really want to do that. I mean, it wasn't like I was, you know, well, I just didn't want to do it, get involved. So we kind of drifted apart. So when I came down to Glasgow, I was sort of seeking in all sorts of bits and pieces, went to various churches. I had a friend, or it wasn't even a friend, a guy who was at school with me that I didn't really know until he came down here. Turns out he was a Christian guy. He said, oh, when we go back to Aberdeen, you must come to this church that I go to. So I said, yeah, fine. I went to this church I was just sort of bowled over. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. The guy was preaching out of 2 Kings on stuff. I had no idea what he's talking about. But what often happens with me is that, you know, when I'm sort of listening to people, I'm not really listening to people in some way. It's like God had was speaking to me. I couldn't use these words then, but listen to this guy, he's speaking the truth. You know? So when I left that service, I thought, this is it, you know, this man is speaking the truth, or even more, the Bible is somehow true, which is, I couldn't quite get my head around that to begin with. That was the start of my kind of journey. But the other thing about this church I attended a few years later on a regular basis was the actual music, because not it was particularly sort of professional, but it's introduced me to a whole side of the music world that I didn't really know anything about, particularly sound tunes, song which was a heritage. And that really blew my mind. It sounds strange perhaps saying that here, but it was really amazing. A couple of weeks ago, Alan read from Psalm 24. When he was reading it, I was singing to myself, "You gates, lift up your heads." Oh, I can't help that. It's just amazing.
Did you find it? Having that musical connection to the Psalms was actually the way that you internalised and almost memorised parts of the Psalms, or just it became a familiar part of your...
I think it certainly helped me just sing out some of God's words in a way that I wasn't really aware of. There are, some of you might know, in the old sort of church called the Hindu, there's the Psalms, the hymns, in between them as a paraphrases. I remember singing paraphrase number 48, which was Romans 8, you know.
Wow.
The Saviour died but rose again, triumphant from it. I mean, like, it's just
amazing.
It's the scripture, isn't it? St. Andrews, you know. The other bit that I remember and love singing was a paraphrase of part of Isaiah 2, where Isaiah talks about turning swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, and we will study war no more. You know, it's all there, Isaiah 2. And that really blew me, because I'd been listening to Joni Mitchell turning bombers into butterflies. I thought, this guy had this 2.5 millennium. How did he do it? So that really blew me away. You know, so I really, anyway.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Had you had, was there any kind of faith journey or kind of Christian influence within your family, or was this a kind of new awakening kind of at that point of leaving home? Or?
I've always felt that there was something sort of missing at home. Mm-hmm. And I sort of grew up with parents who sort of attended the church, because that's what parents did at that stage. And this is obviously a bit longer ago than Neil. And my parents were of almost a different generation to my friend's parents, because they were a bit older and very traditional. So the church was part of their sort of life, but not in any meaningful way. So I was just aware that I was seeking, and my other friends didn't seem to want to seek the same as I did.
That's great. So, do you want to tell us a wee bit about your second piece of music?
Neil's already mentioned the tunes that we choose don't necessarily represent our sort of favourite tunes or whatever. This next one is a psalm tune, which is it's quite evocative. I learned actually on the sleeve of the CD that I got this from, which I'll say about a minute, two of the Covenanters sang Psalm 23 to this particular tune, which is actually called Martyrs. In my psalm book at home, the tune Martyrs is dated 1612, so probably it was about before that, but again, that just blows my mind. It's 400 years ago.
Yeah.
And we are still singing this. We're singing this tune, the words that these poor ladies sang. Excuse me. There was a guy, David McGuinness, who I think at the minute he lectures in Glasgow University. He had a band called Concerto Caledonia, who he just put together to do sort of Scottish things. So he resurrected lots of Scottish pieces that were written in a more sort of formal style.
Okay.
So there's lots of folk tunes and all that. So anyway, this particular thing, Martyrs, is on the CD. But prior to that, the fiddler, Canadian guy, David Greenberg, he plays a kind of Eastern European introduction, which has nothing to do with the tune. It's really, that is just a kind of musical thing.
Yeah.
But it's just this kind of haunting tune of Martyrs and just the whole idea of these covenanters, you know.
Let's have a listen then.
So, first 30 seconds, the fiddler. Yeah.
So that's the beautiful melody there. So, okay. I would like to maybe just ask you a little bit more about kind of life beyond that. So you maybe tell us what you studied at university and what you went on to do kind of after that.
Yeah. I did engineering at university, but just because I sort of drifted into it, I knew pretty early on I wasn't an engineer because I just don't like machines. They sort of break down when I look at them. I just have this thing about machines. But anyway, I find it quite interesting, sort of academically interesting. Anyway, I'd done a couple of summer jobs, one summer job actually by that time, in a mental hospital. I thought, how do I, because I sort of enjoyed it, but I knew that I didn't really want to make that my life. How do I sort of tie up mental hospitals and engineering? So I went into teaching.
Fantastic.
Anyway, it wasn't. I went into teaching, and to begin with, I thought, what am I doing with this for? I found it really difficult, not least because we got married, I was unsettled in myself, and so on. And I think one of the things that sort of rumbled on the background for quite a long time in my life. as the church that we've been to, become part of the church, feel part of it, neither of us really did for almost decades, it seems. And work was going on in the background, which I didn't really find easy for a whole variety of reasons. So there was a sort of grey period of 20 or 30 years. life just sort of happened. It felt like life was happening to you. You couldn't really predict. You just sort of prayed, nothing else happens today or so. That sort of thing.
What were you teaching? Was it
maths?
Maths, and as a secondary school teacher.
As a secondary school teacher, and so I taught maths, and I was a private school, so they did rugby, which I hated. I was quite popular with the kids because they realised I didn't like rugby, so they hated rugby as well. The highlight of my week was Wednesday afternoon when I would take some guys cross country running, and that was me and my element. I just felt totally free. The running has sort of rumbled on in the background of my life because it was one of these places where, and don't get me wrong, Eric Liddell sort of said that when he runs fast, he feels God's pleasure. Mm. And in a strange way, when I ran, don't forget about the fast thing, but just when I ran, that's sort of, I just loved it, so I don't know if God was just giving me that to kind of help me through a whole period of my life.
You mentioned there getting married. How did you meet Isabel, your wife?
I did the 4 years at Glasgow University, and I wasn't happy in Glasgow, and I wanted to leave Glasgow. And just before I eventually leave Glasgow, I met Isabel. So I had planned to go back to Aberdeen to do a teacher training thing. And then get a job out there. So I did the year and then came back down here. But what is it? And again, this is something that's part of both of our lives. I was fascinated by Francis Schaeffer. He wrote the book, as a name, it's not really mentioned nowadays very much, but he wrote the book, The God Who Is There. When I first went to church that time, that friend took me to church, and I felt that somehow God is there. What really blew me away was words that I couldn't express this in words at the time, but Hezekiah has a prayer in Isaiah 38, and part of that is kind of thanking God for saving his soul from nothingness. Mm. I think that day in Gilkenston, Aberdeen, my soul was saved from nothingness. I don't know if I was necessarily a Christian or anything like that, but it just... just a huge release, relief. Isabel had been in La Brie in Francis Schaeffer's place in Holland for 3 months. So when we met, we had loads to speak about. Mm. She'd been there, I'd read the books, and didn't make much sense of them. But we got married in 75. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Well, we're going to move on to your third selection now. When this came in, I was smiling because when I studied music at uni, and I made the mistake of telling my piano teacher once that I didn't like Bach, and my piano teacher said, "Oh right, we'll see about that." And proceeded to give me loads of Bach, and then I absolutely grew to love it, I have to say. So you've selected a piece of Bach. Do you want to tell us about that?
My memories of early marriage, one of the memories of early marriage is me decorating rooms, listening to quartets and so on from the radio. But Bach, I love to play, I love to try and play, and I've done that for years and years. So Bach wrote two solo pieces for, a whole lot for solo cello and a whole lot for solo violin. And some of the violin stuff is just, I just find totally amazing. Well, it's not just me. In the Sunday said, on the eighth day, God created Bach. And that's almost how I feel, actually. This is a track that's it's quite sort of jumpy compared to some of it, but it's not the sort of thing you would whistle to unless you've got sort of hyperactive lips. But there's something spiritual about it. Mm. And
It's incredible music, isn't it? So let's have a listen to this Bach. Brilliant, fantastic. Okay, so do you want to tell us a wee bit about kind of more recent life and maybe how you've ended up kind of connected into our community in White Inch and things like that?
So I said that we were, you know, sort of had gone around one or two churches trying to be part of the churches, and increasingly it wasn't working, and and we were reading all sorts of bits and pieces, and speaking to other folks who are in different churches. So we started reading, some of the Bethel stuff. And then in 2007, I had to take out a guitar because of my health, and Isabel later on that year had to go through a big operation, etc. I thought maybe we could get a satellite TV. We did, because it wasn't too easy to use a neighbour's dish. But we started watching, you know, Bethel on Sky, and there's just a whole sort of series of things working together. The place where we had been had become sort of unworkable. We left within 3 or 4 weeks, I think, we were here, because Isabel had been helping out at the ailing rooms. She knew one or two of you guys, so it seemed a sensible place to come, we've been here ever since. So that's sort of 3.5 years.
Just for anyone who doesn't know, Bethel is a church in California, and you guys have actually visited there, haven't you?
Yeah. That was an amazing experience. Yeah.
That's somewhere that God is doing a lot, and so we'll come to talk about that more. Well, in the meantime, let's another very interesting selection that again reminded me of being at uni and studying music. You've selected us a piece of music by Steve Reich.
Yeah.
You want to tell us a bit about that and where that fits into your life story?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I've always been fascinated by is rhythm. Mm-hmm. Obviously the drums, but not particularly drums, but it's a rhythm. So when I was a school kid, the school had a pipe band, and one of my friends said, "Oh, they're looking for drummers." I thought, "Oh, wow, that's amazing! Well, what an opportunity!" And you battered on desks, your pads, and some of your drumsticks. And then what I didn't realise was you had to put on all this stuff. I mean, it sounds crazy. They had this big box of uniforms, stuff, and all that. So they couldn't really find a kilt small enough for me, so they really had to use belt and braces to pull this thing up. So I think that really jaundiced me about wearing kilts. Definitely got a thing about kilts. Anyway, so percussion, yeah, so there's a whole chunk of time where you know, the music was composed really. I wasn't interested in classical stuff. I know the classical period, I wasn't really interested in that, but some of the modern stuff did interest me. So this particular guy writes in a certain way. Philip Glass, I think he's probably more popular. He's written one or two film scores, I think. But they have a particular way of writing, a minimalist thing they call it. But this particular track depicts a train journey from one side of America to the other. Steve Reich, someone suggested, a Jewish man, and his mum lived in Los Angeles, his dad lived in New York, and every summer holiday he'd go across the continent in a train. So the title of the whole track thing is Different Trains. So later on, the second part, what we want here, is of a different train, and that's the train going from Germany to Poland. I remember the first time I heard this, I really cracked up. And the word over the music, you hear voices, you hear words, fast train to Los Angeles, fast train to New York, and other bits and pieces. The second movement, it's in German, but they've now done it, how they've done it in English. And it's really, really haunting. I can only listen to it at certain times, actually, sure. Because it is so powerful. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, brilliant. So when you listen to this, what really amazed me when I listened to it is it really sounds like a train, but actually if you tune in you'll hear it's all just instruments,
strings.
Just real instrument strings. So have a listen. This is Different Trains, Steve Reich. From Steve Reich there. Okay, so well, finally, Brian, do you want to tell us maybe just about kind of what God's been doing in your life recently and kind of where he's leading you guys, and maybe just tie that into your last election as well?
Yeah, so we came here about 3 years ago, and I remember not long after we came here speaking to Glenn about Glenn and I's trip to out to Bethel in San Francisco and how he got there and all that, and I really love to go there. And then I mentioned my wife Isabel, she'd had some major surgery and things didn't go too well and all that to begin with, but she started to get better. So one night we were watching a Bethel thing on TV. And Derek Johnston was interviewing this Norwegian family, had a wee boy, the wee boy seemingly had been dying before parents brought him across from Norway to, parents were Norwegian, from Norway to Bethel to be prayed for, because they didn't have any hope really for the wee guy. They prayed for him, and long story short, he was fine. He was just miraculously healed. So when I saw that on the telly, I said to them, well, we've got to go there. I want to have these guys to pray for you. And they have a special healing service on a Saturday. So I said, we'll go for 2 weekends. So that's, you know, twice to pray for them.
Brilliant.
Being the mathematician. that was in January. So we went out on the June. And it really was just an amazing experience just to be part of it. I remember just driving up there and, you know, seeing Bethel, and I thought, I've got to take a picture of this. You know, we've been there, we're here. As well, was prayed for quite a number of times, actually. Just people just pray for it. Just really quite an exceptional place. And she's better. So she's now doing a counselling course. That's why she's not here. She really had no energy, she's still not 100% kind of mechanics of things. She's just a different person. So for both of us, we were just seeing God work in incredible ways. We were just hoping to see God continue to work in incredible ways, and all the testimonies we hear from you guys, and it's just it really is just amazing. So my last tune is Jen Johnson singing.
God, I looked.
Yeah, God, I looked. Yeah, I can remember. So she was
right.
Beautiful.
Okay, well let's listen to a wee piece of this then. Okay, very finally, I'll just ask you quickly, have you any idea what the future holds for you guys?
Not really. Not really. So I suppose hoping to help out the counselling here. I'll just carry on.
Fantastic.
Helping out.
there's a real sense, I would say, of you guys finding your stride more and more in terms of coming into life, and you know, you've got so much experience and so much wisdom, but it's like God has really planted you here for, you know, for more, and it's just brilliant to get to see that. So Brian Kelman, everybody. And finally, I would love to welcome Diane McWilliam.
It's so interesting. I've only 5 minutes left.
No, we started a little late. You're all right.
This is very exposing.
You're in the hot seat now. That's right. Okay, I have your selections all loaded up. So, this is very exciting. Diane,
why don't you tell us, first of all, where were you born and a little bit about childhood and growing up?
Okay, so I was born in Paisley in January 1968. I know you've all been doing, if you're in the meal, you've been doing the sums and trying to work it out. I'm just telling you, I'm 48, so fine. Okay. So we stayed in the south side of Glasgow. My mum was a nursery nurse, my dad was a computer programmer, which was quite kind of changed in the days when computers took up a room twice the size, kind of stuff. And as he was doing the south side of Glasgow, I have a younger sister, 3.5 years younger than me. We did not get on as children at all, but we do now, which is fine. It's kind of weird because I'd just like to just know we didn't have a big list of questions or anything. It was just like, give us your music, and the other two guys have both said that the music, if you'd asked us to pick five pieces of music that was our favourite five pieces of music, we would have got a different list from this. But picking music that kind of ties in with your life is quite a different question, or quite a different kind of request. So I'd just like to say that the first piece of music is not something I would choose or ever listen to. Just put that out there now. So music was not a big thing in our house. The radio tended to be on, and my dad's mother, my granny, was a concert label pianist, but he's not musical at all, and there was a huge pressure on his family to be musical, and he'd kind of let the thing down, and so there was just a bit of an issue around all that, you know, in our family. So it wasn't a big thing. So my parents listened to, like, Val Dunigan. Brian, you'll know who that is. I think you're probably the only one who will.
Yeah,
my parents listened to Val Dunigan.
Val Dunigan, The Spinners, and the big trendy thing when Billy Connolly put his album out, it was a bit risky, and we listened to it when my parents weren't in. Literally, I'm sweetie words. And the other thing was Cliff Richard. My mother was so in love with Cliff Richard. It wasn't true. And you kind of imbibe things before you know any better.
No excuses.
Cliff Richard and the Shadows used to do a show on the telly on a Saturday night. I suppose the kind of equivalent of the Ant and Dave slot now. There's a photo of me I must have been about 2.5, gazing at the telly at Cliff Richard and nothing short of adoration. It was embarrassing. So
I think that segues neatly on your first selection, which is congratulations, Cliff Richard. Here we go. Let's have a listen. Classic. See, I don't know.
Yeah, that's enough.
I wondered if this was going to be part of the story of how excited you were when you met Alan.
Early childhood put far
amazing. Fantastic. Okay, so why don't you tell us a bit about your the next stage of your life, teenage years and
I tried to do one per decade and it didn't quite work out like that, but so primary school was fine. I was kind of smart but not the smartest, and I was a wee bit kind of not very fit and not very I just kind of a wee bit on the edges of stuff. I had pals, I'm not completely pals, but just kind of a wee bit socially awkward, a wee bit not quite fitting in. I wanted to be a vet. That's been quite a thing.
Yeah.
And so I spent my kind of holidays and weekends and things poking around the garden and collecting beetles and. Over across from where we stayed, there was a kind of burn, which I suspect was a kind of sewage outlet, to be honest. And it was a crazy, but it had trees, and I was quite a tomboy, and I spent all my time kind of up trees and watching birds and trying to anytime my parents were big and kind of going places, and days out and the summer holidays were a big thing, So I basically drove them all nuts by sitting on beaches and trying to persuade seals. They all talk to me or poking around golf course and coming back with really interesting things.
Amazing.
I found. And my mother really didn't appreciate that at all. however, but primary school was fine. I mean, I've got kind of mostly good memories of that.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have a teacher who introduced us to classical music. And it's kind of a desert islandish thing. You've got a bit of classical music in it. I've got a bit of classical music. I think around primary seven, when the rest of my class was all going to see Grease and falling over John Travolta, I was listening to classical music. And I think it's one of these things, in hindsight, I recognise, I suppose it was a wee bit of me kind of on the edge, and if I wasn't going to be accepted, well, I'll just be different anyway and deliberately different. But at the time, you don't really, you know, when you're age 10 or 11, you don't really think like that. But I suspect that's what was going on.
Yeah.
And so I didn't see Grease until it was out on DVD, I think. Selling video. Just moving on.
That's all good. So your second selection is a classical piece. And is this a particular piece that you remember?
Well, it is. Our teacher in primary 6 and 7, our class is a bit of an... I went to a very big primary school. I think it's still one of the biggest in Scotland. And so there were four classes in each year group. And our class had a bit of a reputation. Nobody really wanted us more than once. I'm taking no responsibility for that, but Mrs. Thomas in primary 6 decided she would take us back, and she was just great, just one of these tremendously creative primary teachers. She had a bit of a temper, and you know, you didn't really want to mess with her, but just massively creative. We did some amazing projects and stuff, and she was the first person I think who ever taught us, certainly taught me to listen to music rather than just have it on in the background, which is what happened at home. There was no kind of appreciation or critique of anything that we listened to. Well, you can tell us feathers and proper. but she actually taught us to listen to what was going on and to use your imagination. And I think the other thing about spending your life kind of up trees and chasing beetles is that you do have quite a kind of active imagination.
Okay.
Rather than, you know, and we stayed quite far from the school. My pals were all kind of halfway up the road, and so and I didn't get on my sister, as I say, so I did spend quite a lot of time in my head.
Mm.
And classical music just seemed to fit that. I could hear, well, I mean, this is Fingal's Cave Overture, so I could hear the storm, and I could imagine the cliffs and the island, and it just kind of fitted somehow.
Okay, well, let's listen to a bit of Felix Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, which is known as Fingal's Cave. Did you ever play classical music, or were you a listening appreciator?
I did statutory piano lessons, and then got wheeled out in front of my granny to play, and that was just awful. My piano teacher was quite blunt, and he used to say that if he merged us, he would have one terrible piano player and one really good one. Apparently, my sister had a nice touch, but I was good in theory.
Okay. Good in theory.
And good at theory.
Or good at theory. On paper, yes. Okay, that's great. Okay, do you want to tell us a wee bit about kind of moving beyond school and what you did next?
I kind of wonder actually if I should do it was hard enough picking five songs.
Sure,
so
sure.
But I did kind of wonder about having another song to go with, like a Christian song to go along. But surrounded by the air, kind of the wise man Billy's house upon the rock was the thing that was, and I think because my parents went to church and I went to church, nobody told me until I was a teenager or until I went to high school that I needed to choose to be a Christian.
Okay.
But I am grateful for that very solvent. I mean, I know scripture because I went through Sunday school from like zero and got told all these stories, and the fact that I didn't work out what they were all actually about until much later. And I am grateful for that foundation. So, kind of through teenage years, I discovered a scripture union, hugely influential in terms of my faith and life in general. I met Alan at a scripture union leaders kind of training event when I was 17.
Wow.
And just in terms of bringing about like-minded friends, there was nobody in my church really, apart from one lady who'd been a missionary, who'd expressed their faith in the way that I did, and it felt quite isolating. And my big teenage rebellion was not drink or drugs, but going to the Baptists.
Wow. Amazing.
You know, you're laughing, you have no idea the angst that caused in my family. So, and it was partly because it was all about what it looked like. And, you know, it was, anyway.
And did you come to faith through Scripture Union then? Or?
Yeah, effectively. I mean, the emphasis on reading your Bible stuff, I'd never really read my Bible seriously. And then when I started high school, I started going to the SU group and just finding all these people, and it was like mind-blowing. And I came to faith kind of basically in my own room, reading my own Bible, being challenged by the words of Jesus to the Pharisees, bizarrely. I suppose in one sense it's not a surprise, because I'd been brought up in this family group, it was all about what we looked like on the outside.
Yeah.
It was, you know, you hid the crap that was on the inside, and you showed a good face, and you got dressed up, and it all looked good. And so the thing that actually I think swung it for me was when Jesus was talking to the Pharisees about being whitewashed tombs, you know, they're looking good on the outside, but inside full of dead bones. And it was just that, oh, that's me.
Yeah.
But still needing help to work out what actually looked like, what meant to follow God. So SU and the SU group at school, later get involved in Scripture Union in terms of them being a training leader and then leader at camp and stuff. And then leadership like camp leader. It's great. So hugely grateful to SU,
okay,
for the influence that they had. And I suppose because, you know, they brought Alan across my
Great. So you met Alan at age 17. And what was life beyond school? What did that entail for you next?
Went to uni. I mentioned earlier I wanted to be a vet. So basically, if you want to be a vet, you've got to go and work in farms. You've got to go work in large animal practice, small animal practice, and do lambing and do everything else. And I basically spent all my summers, all my holidays, being particularly for the kind of top half of high school, going to various farms. And I worked for a local vet and kind of during term time. And it's such a huge investment, and then I was 1 point short, 1 year short. I had to place in one year short in my 6 year exams and didn't get in.
Okay.
Cried for about 3 days.
Yeah.
Just did not, because I'd never thought of anything else.
Yeah.
Like, I was going to be a vet. I was going to be a vet in Africa, you know,
missionary,
you know, missionary and whatever, but I just did not know what to do. So I ended up going to uni and doing zoology, which is fun because I got to poke about rock pools as opposed to just taking things from my mother and saying, look, well, she made pieces. So, no, I had a good time at uni. Having met Alan at 17, I kind of lost touch with him a bit and got back in touch when he came up to uni, because he's that wee bit younger than me. I have a toy boy. Just before he says anything about that, you would think it was decades of me, because it was actually 5 months. went to uni, came out of uni, not entirely sure what to do. Interestingly, I was surprised again, just kind of being around SU and doing kind of Christian youth work, there was almost an expectation that I would teach.
Yeah.
But actually, I quite liked young people and didn't really want to get into teaching, wanted to continue to like young people. Thought about social work briefly. But again, it just didn't feel quite right. So I did a little of random things actually after uni. We got married quite young. We were married at 20, so Alan was still studying when I just kind of finished. I was unemployed, so on the brew for a while. I worked in a deli, worked in the pathology lab in the Victoria Infirmary, got into the civil service and worked in Locate Scotland, which was part of the Scottish Enterprise. Joined Scottish Enterprise was kind of new, and Locate Scotland was all about bringing big companies into Scotland to set up patches and stuff. So that was fascinating, learned loads there, learned just about work culture, office culture, really practical stuff about kind of filing and databases and computers and all that kind of stuff. But also just about people and about what working culture is like. I guess I knew it wasn't my kind of life's work. I don't really think I knew what was, but I knew that wasn't. But it was a great preparation grade. I learned loads. And there was a wee bit of power dressing, that was fine. I had to wear skirts and high heels. But met some really interesting people as well, because my actual job, I worked in a briefing section, so we did a lot of the kind of stats and support for the other. We had like regional desks, so the American desk and the European desk and the Asian desk and stuff, and so we did a lot of support work for them. But it also meant if there was like press conferences or brand openings or stuff, I got to be involved in them. So I did mostly it was at the point where Malcolm Rifkind was in and was out again, Ian Lang, Thingy Stewart with the big bristles. He was a bit challenging to work with, mostly because he was usually drunk. Did one with Margaret Thatcher, for which there was more security than there was for the one I did for Prince Charles.
Wow.
But just so just really interesting kind of piece of work.
Wow.
And so the last thing I did before I left that office, I did some work the last kind of 6 months or 9 months I was there, I was their computer systems manager, and we moved from a Dos based system to Windows. That was 1992, folks. And the last piece of work I handed in was whether or not we should buy email software, because was it worth investing in or not?
Wow. Mm-hmm. And which side did you come down on?
I definitely said yes, I was so glad. I could have been more embarrassing.
The future has borne that out, that's good.
Yep.
Okay,
so,
well, do you want to tell us about your third selection?
Yeah, so this is, I've chosen Runrig track, and Runrig, I suppose there's a bit of romanticism about the whole kind of Scottishness and being Scottish, and when you're younger in particular, it's all very SNP, except I didn't know what that meant then, but it just, there was a kind of something quite romantic about the hills and the mountains and, you know, Robert the Bruce and Lord and all the Amazon. But I was a Highland dancer as well, and Runrig and a rock chick, as it turned out in secondary school. And Runrig just seemed to pull all that together. So there was a bit of rock in it, and there was a bit of this kind of Highland romanticism. And when I started uni, we probably became a bit of a groupie, and I saw them like about three times because they played all the Freshers' Weeks.
Uh-huh.
So we basically kind of toured around all the Freshers' Weeks. We saw them about four times in a row, you know. And also their big live concert, Walk Roland. And it was just, and so that whole kind of period, I think from being the very top end of high school, kind of through student years and beyond, Runrig was probably part of that soundtrack.
Great. Fantastic. So. Well, we're going to listen to a bit of Nightfall on Marsco, which is off the album Recovery.
It is.
Thank you.
conjures a lot of memories. My parents were big. My dad particularly was a big Run Rig fan, and the first concert I ever went to was Run Rig at the Inverness Ice Rink. So it was slightly after the recovery era, but certainly that sound and just the kind of that's part of what made me want to play guitar and all that stuff as well. So
there you go.
Good choice.
Thanks.
Okay, so tell us.
Next
era of your life.
Okay, so next, Alan graduated from finally from uni. We headed to Edinburgh for 18 months, and obviously the Scottish office is big in Edinburgh, and so I thought it'd be quite easy to get. That's why we chose to go there. We thought it was a good time to make a break from Glasgow because all our kind of routes were there, and all our pals were there, and we were going to have to leave. We were going to go. I mean, obviously Alan's a trained guitarist, so we wanted to do what God. Where God called us, and so we thought make a break at that point for the short period somewhere where we knew I could get a job, and then we would kind of take it from there. And so we kind of looked at jobs. I kind of put in for my transfer, and it was kind of really sense came up. And we knew by that point we were going to Wester Hills, and in Wester Hills there's a thing called the Wester Hills Partnership. It was one of four projects that the government has set up, working in schemes. Trying to work out a kind of partnership thing with kind of council and stuff. It was one post at my grade, and the guy left a fortnight before we were due to go.
Wow.
It was absolutely God given. I mean, there's no other word for it. God given a role job. And that's where I discovered community work. And it was almost, it was a pity me talking about people's the lights going on. It was just working in this place and suddenly thinking, I get it. Okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be working in communities. I'm supposed to be, because I think the bit of this I said Glasgow was brought up in was quite middle class. The church was quite, you know, people went because you were supposed to. Again, it was a bit over what it looked like, and I always felt quite uncomfortable with the. I just felt really shallow and a wee bit false. And I actually worked in Wester Hills, and by that point I'd already been doing a bit of kind of voluntary work in communities, and it just all kind of came together and made sense, and I thought, yes, yeah, what am I about?
Yeah.
So we were there for a year and a half, amazing time in Wester Hills, and when we were drawing to a close, Alan and I agreed that we were looking, whatever God was going to call us, that was fine, so he was job hunting, and I would probably leave the Scottish office or go part-time the Scottish office and try and do some community-based work with a view to come back to uni. We got called back to Glasgow, back to Scotland Finance, for which we were so happy. We'd done Alan done one of his student placements there, so we were going back to Frayne, so Iris was there. Just, it was so lovely.
Scotland Whitehead Church, Scotland.
Scotland Church, Scotland was Alan's first job as a Minister, Associate Minister there. So we're called back to Glasgow, lovely, and he was doing that, and I ended up working for Victim Support at that point, so that was my first proper kind of community sector job. And that was good. So the plan was for me to go back to uni eventually, but I loved doing what I was doing with Victim Support, stayed on, fell pregnant, at the same time as I got my first uni place, really only one of those you can defer, so uni got shelved, and David arrived. And that was so much fun that we did it again. And Stephen came, and most of you know our lovely boys. And meanwhile, Alan's working in Scotland, and mostly in White Inch, and doing some programmes and youth work and all sorts of stuff. And I was working for Sport. Just great, had a ball. I mean, it was good fun. There was we were just having fun. I mean, it's like, oh my goodness, how can you possibly get paid for having this much? And there was, it was a bit of trauma and all, but it wasn't smooth, so I wouldn't like to come and see that, but it was just great fun, and it was all sorts of, I mean, when you're trying to kind of reduce your life to kind of 10 hours of fun, it was a bit of a challenge.
Absolutely.
So it was great fun. Boys came along and grew up. We actually moved into White Inch when they were at baseball. I think David was in nursery and Steve was me. And Iris boys had them the kind of couple of nights where we were moving. Iris had them, and it's the kind of phone call. hey, Diane, I think you should come and see this. And they brought the chicken pox. Holy Santa Iris for looking after our chicken pox egos. I think that might have been in the decan realm.
Was the planting of White Inch Church of Scotland around the same time as the boys?
Yeah, we kind of measured it with them, because now I need to get this exactly right, but David was born at the end of 96, and that was really when White Inch Fellowship became a thing.
Okay.
And Stevie was born at the beginning of 1999, and his first birthday, or the day after his first birthday, was the day that Alan got fired from his associate's job and reinstated as the new parish minister of the new parish of White Inch, or the church of White Inch. So we do kind of measure it with them. And I mean, it's been interesting, they've had such a exposure to Christian things, and I suppose I'm so grateful for all the folk around the church who have been, I mean, everybody from Auntie Iris to, you know, like James and Ali and some of you guys as well, having either babysat Jackie or, you know, been involved in Encounter or whatever, or camp with them. And you know, like lots of teenagers, they've at these points both kind of moved away from faith, and David last summer bounced back spectacularly, came back, and Stevie's currently still away. But do you know, I know that he's heard from God, and I know that he's committed to God, and I know that God's bigger than all the stuff that his pals is telling him, and all the stuff that his science teachers are telling him, and all the stuff that he's reading on the internet. And
yeah.
So I suppose, you know, not that I don't pray for him and I'm concerned for him, but I just know that God's bigger than all that. So
we think you're an inspiration, the way you relate to the boys. I remember that was something that Rebecca and I noticed very early on, the dynamic and the way that you are with them is brilliant. So just wanted to say that. Why don't you tell us about your next choice, the next piece of music from Queen?
Well, this is actually with the boys as well. I mean, I've loved Queen. The first album I ever bought actually was the album that this came off of, which was The Game, when I was, I don't know, like 12 or I think. But we also, we didn't, not a few days old, but we did do the, okay, we really need to make sure our boys have got a good taste in music. And so when they were quite young, actually, we basically picked an artist and treated ourselves to a new CD each summer, and that's what we would play. And Queen was one of the first ones, because I love Queen. Just so much stuff. So I've chosen Save Me, because it's off The Game, because that was the first album I bought. Also, in my head, I'm an amazing singer. I'm not really a singer, but if I was this good, this would be my karaoke track. I think in actual fact, my karaoke track's something completely different. But if I could sing, if I could sing, this would be my karaoke track. But I just
fantastic.
Love it. I just think Freddie Mercury's got amazing voice and stuff. So.
Okay, well, let's listen to a bit of Queen then. Here we go.
So
tell us just a little bit about kind of recent life and what God's been doing with you recently, and kind of where you're headed, and maybe, I don't know,
okay.
If that maybe ties into your last selection as well.
I suppose I did eventually go back to uni and community development. By that point, I'd probably done enough community work that I knew I knew there was stuff that I didn't know. You know, maybe you kind of go to mains and you kind of think, I've just completely missed something here. So I went back to uni with great intentions of doing, I went to Glasgow uni. I deliberately chose not to do a Bible college community course. I wanted to do a secular course. But I was going to do a bit of theological reflection as I went through. Oh my goodness, that lasted about 2 minutes. I got to the first question of my first term, thought my head was going to explode. I'm a scientist, and so you ask questions and there are right answers. See all this stuff about writing essays about your experience and what you think, and oh my goodness, terrible. Anyway, I loved it. Where else do you get to set, like, seriously, we were this really hand coffee break one day, we've been doing some stuff around kind of philosophical political background to give you stuff. They actually sent us off to have our coffee and talk about what is truth, is technology helpful to the future of humankind? And by that point, genuinely, and at that point, I'd been around long enough and, you know, I'd made some good, great friends there. And, you know, all I did, I had to do was sit quietly and they all talked to me and said, Diane, do you have something to say about this? What did you, you know, because I know Chris, what did you have to say about that? Well, I have something to say. It was a gift, it was great. Just loved it. I love being back at uni. So since then, I was working for the church at that point, actually, which was great. So working in White Inch, being involved in the New Centre and various other bits. Since then, I've worked over in the South Side with asylum seekers and refugees. A lot of that's just really interesting. Having had, as a child, this whole thing of going to be in Africa, suddenly having a load of Africans coming into my workplace. Just what an opportunity. Love that, mostly when we were belly up at the end, some people know, but that's okay. Now working for Redeemer Communities, which kind of sums up where I think I've been going.
Yeah.
You know, when you kind of look back, it's all the hindsight, then you look back and think, oh yeah, God taught me that there, which prepared me for that, and then God taught me that there, which prepared me for that. And it does just feel, as I look back, that there's, like, God's in his hand and all. I kind of feel I'm a bit rubbish at knowing what the big picture is, but in retrospect, you can kind of see, you know. And so now I know that this whole thing about transformation is a theme, whether it's around me, whether it's around, like, personally, because, you know, we're all a work in progress, whether it's about the church, and, you know, I've loved being involved in the church plan and being around the kind of forward stuff, and I suppose kind of adjunct shooter, I'll call myself one. But just being around the kind of forward stuff and the kind of fresh ideas and new ways of connecting with people, and but actually how you transform communities and what the kingdom of God looks like expressed outside the church, because he's out there and he's doing stuff, and, you know, and it's just helping people make that connection. You know, when you're talking to a granny saying my kids are on drugs and and my grandchildren are being looked after by me and it's all this mess and I can't feel this, can't feel that, and you're able to say, well, you know how you love your kids and you want the best for your kids and you want to see that sorted, that's how God feels about you and how God feels about this city and how God feels about this place, and that's what I want to do.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Okay, why don't you tell us just about that very last piece of music you chose then?
Okay, I've chosen about Third Day, again, just kind of great bass line, guitar solos and stuff amongst all that. But Third Day, I love the sound, and I just, some of the stuff they sing is quite profound. Some of it's not, some of it's just, you know, cheesy Christian stuff. But some of it is quite profound, and I just love this track. There was a few, it was quite hard to choose a Third Day track, actually, but I've chosen King of Glory, and just because he is.
Well, let's listen to it then. Here we go.
Spoken words, my conscience.
There we go. Okay. I feel you've kind of already answered my what next question, just with what you said there about how where you're at now kind of just sums up kind of where your heart's at and where you want to go. So, Dan McWilliam, everybody, thank you so much. There we go.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Stop it because it needs your skin.